Thank you for listening to the Content Magazine podcast, Conversations with Silicon Valley's Creatives. I'm Daniel Garcia, your host and the cultivator of Content Magazine, published by SV Creates. This is our second interview with Marcus Lyon, the founder of a Human Atlas project. If you'd like to know more about his photo career and the journey of launching a Human Atlas, go to episode 81, which was recorded in May of 2023. This episode is going to focus more on the current project that was just released in the fall of 2023 called Decoded. Okay, welcome to the Content Magazine podcast, and I'm super excited today because we are revisiting with Marcus Lyon of Humus Atlas, who's actually in town for the release of the Decoded book. So, Marcus, thank you so much for being here. We did a podcast, actually that was back in May of 2022, when you were in town to shoot for the book. So welcome back to California and to San Jose and Silicon Valley.
Thank you. Delighted to be here with you again, Daniel. Thank you so much.
Yeah, great. So I wanted to talk, since we did that other podcast and we got about your life and all the kind of wonderful things of your history of great accomplishments, I wanted to focus a little bit more on this particular project, the Decoded project, that's actually, when we're recording this, is going to be released tomorrow. And then, of course, everybody can buy it online in the future. And we'll talk about that. But the first thing I kind of want to know is, like, I know Kathy Kimball was pretty instrumental in kind of bringing it here. But how did you come to find out our focus on Silicon Valley? Was that something that you did or somebody contacted you? How did that all come to be?
So Kathy and I think, first met back in, gosh, I think it maybe as long ago as 2012 in Houston, at an arts festival down there, the PhotoFest Festival. And we really connected. I showed her some work we'd done in Brazil on the Human Atlas of Brazil, Somos, Brazil. And she was like, that'd be interesting. Maybe we could exhibit that.
Oh, yeah.
And then I think after reflection, she decided that, you know, the Brazilian diaspora in Silicon Valley wasn't that large. And it was interesting, but it didn't have some contextual relevance. And she really challenged me to think about whether we could make a Human Atlas of Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
And then the fabulous fellas and friends and the ladies at Packard came together and said, let's make a Human Atlas of Silicon Valley, and we will help with support and funding. So with the team over at Packard, Kathy on board as curator, and my team of Camilla and Joe, we began designing, creating, and researching the idea of creating Decoded, a Human Atlas of Silicon Valley, to map 101 change agents across this region who were making significant social change in their streets, neighborhoods, and beyond through their incredible work. So it was a build from there. Absolutely delightful.
How long was that project? How long did it take actually then to when you were here in May of 22 shooting to, you know, like what kind, I'm just kind of curious so that people can kind of get some idea.
I mean, a Human Atlas normally takes about 3 years. Yeah. There's a kind of year of research and building the nomination. Everybody who's in our projects is nominated by their community. So it's not us as so-called journalists or documentary makers making choices. It's about a community's voice. Mm-hmm. Then there's a good 6 months of kind of production, collecting the interviews, doing the pictures, doing the DNA testing, bringing that all back to the studio in a finished format. And then there's about another year's worth of post-production.
Yeah.
So that's design, printing, and creating the products, really, at the end. So we also do podcasts, and we also do projections and exhibitions. But what we're launching here in Silicon Valley right now is the book. The book of the stories of 101 extraordinary humans from Silicon Valley.
Yeah, yeah, and it's beautiful. Before we talk about the actual aesthetics of the book and some of the other things, I want to talk just kind of more specifically about the project. And what is the region of Silicon Valley that's kind of like in this particular book? I mean, is it Marin down to Gilroy or kind of like what's out to Antioch or...
We've always done atlases which were geographically defined until now. And the Silicon Valley Human Atlas is defined by the nomination process. It's defined by the locales of the people who are nominated to be in it.
Yeah.
Silicon Valley is really a concept. You know, once upon a time, it was a quite small lozenge, maybe between Palo Alto and Cupertino.
Yeah.
And now it's grown way out to be, you know, really across the Bay Area, San Francisco, Oakland, down the East Bay, obviously with a hot spot, a kind of heat cluster around San Jose, that lozenge from San Jose up to Palo Alto, from Stanford down to where we where we are today. But we wanted to map people because they were doing amazing work in the Bay Area. So we allowed the geography to kind of morph itself into whatever it needed to be. So, we've got Luis Valdez, who lives down in, you know, I think Gilroy Valdez, and beyond.
Yeah.
We've got people like James Rucker, who lives up on Stinson Beach, you know.
Yeah.
We've got people out in Oakland like Tyson Amir. We've got amazing local heroes who do incredible work here, like Luisa Boada in East Palo Alto, or Blanca Alvarado, who obviously is, you know, a big name here in San Jose.
Yeah, that's cool. So it's a little wider than what you've done in Detroit or Brazil or even Germany.
And, yeah, I mean, in Detroit, we were our funding partners, the Kresge Foundation, actually said this has to be Detroit.
Oh, okay.
Not Metro Detroit, not, you know, Southeast Michigan. This has to be Detroit. It was bounded by 7 Mile at the top, or 8 Mile, sorry, and then right down to the Detroit River. So it was the city and no more. If you lived outside or worked outside, you couldn't be in.
Huh,
whereas here we wanted to be looser. We wanted to open this up to kind of, this was about human endeavor in the Bay Area with Silicon Valley as a kind of focus.
Yeah, that's cool. And that's the thing, too. I think in this region, too, I think with Silicon Valley, me as being a San Josean, and I tell people this, it's like, I feel like the whole Bay Area is mine. You know what I mean? Like, I don't feel necessarily San Francisco or even Marin or Sausalito is necessarily so, I mean, it's far, but I still feel like, I own that. I'm a San Josean.
I think so. And I think that, you know, what was really interesting, because we were, you know, we were confident that was the right way forward, but we like to be thought of as people who listen deeply in many different ways. And we found that so many of the people who featured in the book talked about the Bay Area. And I think that was the kind of way it began to frame geographically, even though we felt that wasn't the important thing. We felt the important thing was the work that people were doing to build a future that was more hopeful for our children, to build ideas and ways of doing things that build a more powerful future.
So then you did 101 people, and I know that Brazil was like 50-ish, or was it Detroit?
We've always done 100. That 100? Was always the aim. But here, of course, we had the beauty of it being Silicon Valley. So obviously the power of the chip was the binary process of either being a switch on or a switch off. So we like the kind of on, off, on, off, on, off, you know, 101, you know. So, you know, one being on and zero being off. So we like 101, but we also like the fact that the 101 freeway, like, basically strikes a beautiful line right through this geographical area. So it felt right to do 101. It felt more powerful. It felt like a respectful way of creating a number to work to.
Yeah, that's cool. I didn't even think about the 101 for the freeway. I just thought that you were doing, like, the code, right?
Yeah,
you
know, we did both.
Yeah,
we did both.
That's cool.
It just felt right.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. That's good. Awesome. The thought behind it is beautiful. So let's talk actually a little bit about, well, let's talk about some of the stories of Decoded, kind of in comparison to Detroit or Brazil or Germany. What was something unique that maybe was a surprise theme that you might have found through your different kind of interviews here in our wonderful Bay Area?
Yeah, that's
if there was.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think there are. I think it's a tricky question.
Yeah.
I think it's a powerful question. It's a good question. I think that, you know, we really delve into the uniqueness of each of our people.
Yeah.
So in a sense, we see these each as a data point, and we just really lean into the uniqueness of that person.
Yeah.
So making large-scale comparisons is kind of tricky.
Yeah.
I think what really came out here for us, the bigger themes were definitely the Chicano Latino theme was really powerful.
Yeah.
The indigenous theme, the indigenous peoples of this place, in many ways, both from the original peoples, the Moekmaraloni and the many other tribes of the Bay Area and beyond, but also this feeling that the Chicano culture of this space needed to be honored more, and that it really was the sweat and blood and tears of that cultural space that had made this place possible. From the farm workers' movements of the Central Valley, and then the movement of those people into this place, to the obviously the origins of it being a place of canneries and fruit farms, to then being a place which built itself off, you know, the silicon chip into something globally known, but the underpinnings of it was this Latino culture. And we felt that was really powerful. You know, the work that goes on in East Palo Alto, the work that goes on in East San Jose, we felt those themes were really different from things we'd seen before. Obviously, in Detroit, we were really leaning into Black excellence, but we saw a lot of that too. You know, a lot of African-American folk in the book who were doing extraordinary social change work here. I think in a way, Detroit's really gritty. You know, it's the Motor City. And there's kind of a grittiness that comes out of, you know, the Black African-American experience from America's original sin of slavery through to this kind of renaissance in Detroit, which is really a Black city. So there were some really strong, what you might say, racial themes that came through from Detroit that in a sense here in Silicon Valley, which is this beautiful mosaic of cultures, both from the original colonization processes from first contact, but right through to the Silicon Valley of today, which has brought in so many South Asians, but also then, of course, the Japanese Americans who came way before that wave of technology. So many different themes. And then obviously the movement of you know, African Americans out of the Deep South to escape, you know, Jim Crow to that great migration that, you know, you guys understand that is actually as a foreigner is such a fascinating theme to delve into. You know, this idea of, I think it's 6 million plus movements of people in the early 20th century out of the South to the North, and then obviously over here to the West. So no, lots of beautiful themes, lots of beautiful themes about so many cultures all coming together. And I think as a sort of concluding point on that, I think that the really powerful thing that Camilla and I began to try and grapple with in terms of the sound, the oral history piece and bringing it all together was this search for belonging, this sense of we've all come here from so many different places, but how do we build a society where we feel we belong?
That's cool. So these projects that you're doing, it's basically kind of around identity, right? You've kind of talked about identity. For you, you know, why don't you give us just a little bit about your identity? How do you kind of like identify?
Ooh, that's a good one. How do, Well, I always say I'm a British artist. You know, I've got a Welsh grandmother, Scottish grandfather, other English grandparents. So I kind of, you know, I'm kind of a Northern European mutt if you look at my DNA, bit of French, bit of Scandinavian, bit of German, bit of Irish.
A little bit of everything.
But I'm not sure that's how I identify nowadays. I think I think through this work, I identify as a citizen of the world. And, you know, really the great honor of doing these Human Atlas projects with Camilla and Joe and the rest of the team that support us is the fact that it's so humbling to be around such incredible human excellence. And I think my identity... I think there's a quote that came in our first Human Atlas of Brazil from an amazing Brazilian journalist called Eliane Brun, who works now in the Amazon. She's originally from the south of Brazil. And she says, if I am the sum of all the people stories that I've been told, that I've listened to, that when I speak, I speak as a multitude. And I think in a sense, you know, through the work, which we've been now doing for, you know, pretty much a decade, we've done 500 people are featured in Human Atlases. I'm sort of a product of all of you guys. You know, I'm a person made by others, which is really beautiful. And in a sense, through that process, I've learned to belong and feel very, very, very comfortable in my own skin. And there's a kind of confidence that comes through leaning into being a portal through which other people's stories are told. I mean, it's a lovely, Lovely. I mean, I'm sure you understand a little bit, Daniel, because you're a storyteller and you're a listener and you're a champion of other people's amazing work. So I'm sure that that lands easily in your heart.
Yeah.
But for me, you know, my identity is about you and all the people I've met and all these amazing stories I've been privileged to hear and be able to spread to a wider audience.
Yeah. Well, then you said like the confidence and the comfortableness. What do you think it is? What is it that's happening in listening? And is it just becoming more comfortable around people in a way, and then more comfortable of who you kind of are, and like what's kind of happening in that process? I mean, I think, I feel what you're doing, but I'm
I mean, as an image maker, I think it was always interesting to me that the most difficult photographs to take were the ones of the people I knew the best.
Yeah.
And it made me realize that happened quite early on. I mean, you know, 20, 30 years ago, it was like, wow, why is this so difficult, taking a picture of somebody I know so well? And it was because you couldn't be who that person needed you to be, because you already were someone for them. And one of the beautiful things about the deep listening that comes from this process is that you learn to be whoever you need to be for the other people in the room, but you feel authentic in it, because there's nowhere to hide. When you're doing the deep listening interviews, there's nowhere to hide. You have to be you, because otherwise people see through you immediately. They don't trust you, and then they clam up, and you don't get the oral history depth that we need for these projects.
Yeah.
So in a sense, through the photography and that kind of slightly chameleon-esque process of being an image maker, trying to make somebody feel comfortable, at ease with the camera, which many people aren't, through to now really my prime skill set now is doing what you're doing right now, which is interviewing people, asking a question. I mean, right now you're thinking about what I'm saying, but you're also thinking about what you're going to ask me next. So you're already trying to be ahead. And in doing that, you build this incredible depth of empathy, because you're really leaning into listening to someone, but you're also trying to be there for them when they stop talking.
Which you just did, and now threw me off.
don't worry. We've all been there. I mean, that's where when we're doing these interviews, often Camilla and Joe sit in with me, and they often actually, after I finished a process which we go through, they often ask a final two or three questions. And many, many times, actually, the bit that we use in the final oral histories are the bits that come from Camilla and Joe's questions. So I mean, it's a team effort. But I mean, you asked about my identity, and for me, it's definitely a comfortable place right now. I mean, I'm in my late 50s, so I've been doing stuff like this for a long time. I've been practicing, you know, that whole idea of doing 10,000 hours of anything. You know, I've definitely put in my 10,000 hours.
Do you think that, I mean, what is the, I mean, I kind of, this is kind of fascinating. I think this is important for photographers, you know, portrait photographers or interviewers too. It's just like that. When you're saying like being that for the person, right? But being authentic for yourself. So there is a part of you, like I feel like this too. Like there is a part when I'm doing photos, I'm definitely trying, I am focused on making that person comfortable. And then at the same time, I'm also noticing my own uncomfortableness in the situation. What's kind of like that balance in like doing portraiture and telling stories of who you really reveal of yourself, and how much is that kind of a mask, and how much is it just all placated to get the project? Like, how does that all work together?
I mean, for me, there's, you know, because of the nature of the people we meet who are doing incredible work and, you know, deep people with deep passion about the work, but about humanity. I suppose in a way it's made easier through that, because these people are already offering something exceptional to their communities and our society. So I think I'm in quite a sweet spot there. It's not like I'm having to kind of force a story out of people, because they're big narratives that are right there. It's not like I'm a miner who's going to have to go deep, you know. I literally, it's there. Of course, some people are shy. But I think, you know, leaning into your question is, you know, how do I feel, and where does that come from? I mean, I don't feel uncomfortable anymore. I quite like that vulnerability. I think one of the I don't even know whether it's a technique. I don't know if it's a technique, but one of the processes I use is to be very open about myself quite early on.
Yeah.
You know, maybe share a little story that's quite intimate to give people permission. And this is something actually I've worked a lot on recently inside me, is this idea of seeking permission. And I think actually it's one of the real powerful underpinnings of the Human Atlas process is, you know, Camilla and I seek permission at every stage.
Yeah.
It's like, are you okay with this?
Yeah.
Is this, does this feel right? How can we help you understand what we're trying to do more?
Yeah.
You were nominated by someone, you know, that idea of the intimacy that comes from, you know, you being rung up and said you've been part of the Human Atlas, but, you know, David has nominated you. Oh, David thinks I'm special.
Yeah.
You know, or Alyssa Ray thinks I'm special. I've been nominated by someone who, so there's this intimacy that's built into our process. And that seeking permission to tell a story properly, sharing back information, giving the DNA information back to people.
Yeah.
I mean, on the Atlas we're doing right now with the Getty in Los Angeles, we've been trying to go to a whole nother level in terms of supplying back data and information to people to share before we even get to a point of publishing it.
Yeah.
So,
like, give me an example. What's some of that back?
Well, every single person on the LA project, we've produced a bespoke PDF of their DNA map.
Okay.
So prior to actually designing the maps that go in the book and that might go in the exhibitions, we've actually done an early version which we've shared with the people so they get to see this mapping.
Before you even do the photo?
No. We've done the photos. This is so photos and DNA and interview will happen at the same time.
Right. Yeah.
And then we share it back before we get to the book. So we're just trying to seek permission in a really powerful way, in a really open and authentic way. And I think that's kind of the heart of where I'm at in terms of my interview technique, is to seek permission, share information about myself, which is intimate, so that they go, well, we're all here together.
Yeah.
This is our time. This is, I can reveal important things here because I'm in a trusted space.
Safe space, yeah.
Yeah.
You do have that great ability of making people feel comfortable and that empathy and stuff. Like, I know I felt it. And it's always, like I said before, it's fun for me as a photographer to go into that situation. Because I'm kind of watching, like, what is he doing?
Yeah.
Like, what can I learn from him and doing it? But just the comfortable, you know, Joe and Camilla, just like the environment was just so nice. And you guys shot, you know, it was in a house. And there was a lot of interview in the backyard. And it's kind of fun. Let's talk about some of the uniqueness that you've done with the color and the mapping of the people's ancestry and stuff like that. It's really beautiful.
So we partner with Jim Sutherland and Ethan Brown at Studio Sutherland, and the design is really the piece that makes the whole information we've collected come alive. And Jim and Ethan are top of the game designers. I mean, Jim has got a incredibly storied career. He's won every award there is in European design. Amazing man. But what we do specifically with our teams is we find very strong themes that run the whole way through projects, and that holds our design. So you'll see in the decoded book, it's circles and the number four. So we've divided the circle into four quarters, and that has led us to design a decoded logo.
Yeah.
And if you think about all the letters of decoded, they can all be created out of a circle. Got it? D-E? C-O-D-E-D. Perfectly.
Yeah.
So
all
of them can be designed out of quarters of circles. That's led into themes that the chapters, they're four chapters. Each chapter doesn't say chapter one, it's just a quarter of a circle.
Yeah.
And then two quarters of a circle, then three quarters.
Then
so
the
we
whole,
use those themes. And then we lent into that circular idea, and the front cover is a tree print of a slice of giant sequoia, which we burnt and lacquered and scrubbed clean so that the hard grain stood up and the soft grain got dug out. And then we made a Japanese ink print on it. And that's been turned into the front cover. But when you wrap that round, the front cover has a D on it for D, and the back cover has a C on it for coded. So we got these lovely soft circular themes, and then the four that go through. If you look at some of the maps in the mapping section, there are four towns that sit out of the central circle of the map. So the fours and the circles are still being manifested. The maps of the DNA are actually a map of the world, but created out of circles.
That's fun.
So we've had a lot of fun of running these themes all the way through. I'm not sure anybody's going to pick up on that who's not perhaps got a design brain, and I'm not sure we're intending them to.
Yeah.
But because there's this theme that runs consistently right through it, it feels so consistent and so...
Unified and, it's beautiful.
It works well. And, you know, Jim and the team, and then Sam, who's our in-house graphic designer at the Human Atlas Studio, he's done an enormous amount of work building out all these circular motifs and these design infographics that talk about DNA and place and time. So the final book we're super proud of. It also comes with a beautiful bespoke app, which is lovely for Silicon Valley. Bit of tech in there, and you know, you swipe every portrait with the decoded app, which you download from wherever you get your apps. It's free. And you scan the portrait, scan the face of the portraits, and boom, up will pop a little oral history of 2 to 3 minutes where the person tells you this beautiful, carefully edited oral history of what burns inside them, what drives them, where they're from, where they're going, and what matters the most.
Yeah. And then you're using the colors of the person's outfit to kind of tell about that little tidbit.
Yeah, so we, you know, one of the beautiful things about the Silicon Valley project was the amount of color that came through in the portraits. And that's something that we can't curate. Everybody is instructed to turn up at their photo shoot wearing whatever they feel most comfortable in.
Yeah.
So people turn up, we're not in charge of that.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe somebody will bring two different scarves and we can say that scarf is better than that one. But mainly people are just who they are. And we like that. We want really authentic portraiture. This is not styled fashion portraiture.
Right.
This is you as you.
Yeah.
But the colors were amazing across the 101 people. So we really lent into that. And the portraits became, the colors from the portraits became the palette within which we built the DNA mapping section.
Yeah.
So all the infographics have this extraordinary connection back to portrait and thus are super unique in color because everyone was wearing different stuff and different colors and super honoring. So in a sense, the portrait becomes this point at which we begin to honor somebody who for who they really are through color and voice and through story. It's beautiful, really lovely.
I think it's very ingenious and it's beautiful, and it kind of plays on that whole kind of like interesting balance between the uniqueness of every single person. So each four-page spread is a standalone of a profile of a person, but then in the collection it kind of like shows the whole of kind of like humanity, like that kind of that tension or that, that balance between individuals and community. And, you know, that, that it's really awesome.
We went back when we finished and we basically taken all the DNA. So we've added 101% all together.
Yeah.
And we've mapped and created these maps which represent the DNA of this group of people.
Yeah.
So there's a mapping section at the beginning of the book that allows you to see a full visualization of everything that is present in the book in terms of the geographical ancestral origins of this group of people.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. Tell me, for you, from starting in doing the Brazil, Somos Brazil, and Germany, and Detroit, and now Silicon Valley, and now working on LA. What has been for you, like if you were to look back at your first project, what have you would have done different? Like what have you learned kind of like artistically and even maybe story collectingness, to be an American and make up a word?
I think it's interesting because I don't think I could always have said this about the work I've completed over decades prior to this project. But I remain unbelievably proud of the early work, the Somos Brazil work, which actually back in the day then we didn't even call it Human Alice because it was the first.
Right.
It was only when we did a second one, which we thought, we should...
It's bigger than...
We better come up with a name that explains what we're doing. At the time, we were just bringing portraits, sound, and genetic DNA information together to tell a deeper story.
Was it the Brazil project, to interrupt you, sorry, was that kind of like... You didn't really think there might be other ones. That was kind of like a project you were doing on, and then there's...
It was a one and done.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, okay. We did it because, as I think you know, I married a Brazilian. We have a couple of Brazilian children, and we thought it would be an amazing thing to go and do a deep dive, intimate cultural immersion for our children and our family before we hit what I call the tyranny of term time. So it allowed us to understand Brazil in a way we could never have understood Brazil, especially myself and my children who are, I'm British and they're being educated in Britain. So it was really important. And then after publishing it and it won all these awards, we started getting calls from everywhere going, you know, would you do a Human Alice? You know, so it was like, well, and then 10 years later, that's all we do. So it was definitely a one and done. But back to your original question, Daniel, I think I wouldn't have done anything different. Hmm. But what we are doing differently is that each time we've had a cycle, a new atlas to do, we've determinedly gone at that new challenge, that new project, to build it with contextually relevant design and process.
Mm-hmm.
So each time we've done an atlas, we've gone even further into refining our process. So for instance, so much so that in ALTA, a Human Atlas of a City of Angels, the project we're doing with the Getty down in south of here in LA, we actually took on an equity advisor to help us build a more equitable nomination process.
Oh yeah.
So sure. We actually have underpinned our nomination process by some structure. So for instance, Camilla had the nomination form translated into 19 different languages.
Nice, yeah.
So what we've done is we've begun to lean into perfecting our process in a way to mean that no stone has been unturned in our determination to make it the most relevant and authentic atlas of a place and a time.
Yeah, so it really represents the community. Yeah. That's cool.
And you can just keep going at that. I mean, we could revisit Decoded and tweak some things.
Yeah.
You know, most of our projects have between 300 and 400 people are nominated. I mean, every single one of those people would be relevant to be in a project like this. Yeah. And we always say that.
Yeah.
But we have to try and bring it down to a number in which we can create a book and a finished project. So 100 feels like... You know, if you've done 100 of anything, so, you know, try just, you know, making 100 cups of tea. It takes a long time. You know, I mean, 100 anythings is a big thing.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, too, is like, you know, that selection editing process, who gets in, who gets out, is really, does that, I mean, like, I know even with, like, doing the magazine, like, in some ways it weighs on me because it's like, I mean, the more stories that you kind of, like, tell, it's like, everybody... Individual story is so valuable, right?
Curating that 100,
yeah,
you know, with this project, 101, I should say, is key. You know, the nomination process is the foundation in which we build the house of a Human Atlas.
Yeah.
And if, as we all know, especially here in the Bay Area, if your foundation's not good, you know, things fall down.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and I mean, you know, that's where I have to, you know, really do a big flag waving exercise for Camilla, who dives deep into that nomination process. Yeah. She's the one that reaches out to kind of all elements of community in a space and asks them to nominate into us. And then she helps me curate the final nomination selection process with a committee of kind of wise owls from the space. Yeah. So we really lean into the voice of a place.
Yeah.
You know, it really isn't us making choices. It's about a place telling us what the key stories are that we need to tell.
Yeah, that's good. So let's talk about Camilla just a little bit.
Sure.
Since she's right here in the room, I want to give her some credit to what she does. What kind of does she do with the project, and how's that helped you, and when did she come on board?
Camilla has produced all the Human Atlases other than the one we did in Germany. She was on board for the first one in Brazil. And she's really been an absolute, you know, she's a key part of it. Simply couldn't do the projects without her. She produces the whole work, but she also has a deep intellectual role in how we've built them. I mean, you know, it's been a partnership, really. Yeah. I mean, I'm the lucky guy who gets the name on the outside of the book, but, you know, I'm always in a position where I want to tell the story about how much, you know, influence she's had on the piece. I always turn to her when I'm stuck. She always helps me unpick thorny issues. If there's something we're really, really worried about, it's always a conversation between the two of us to solve it. You know, yeah. I mean, I don't really move on these Human Atlas projects without her guidance. But I think the thing that, you know, really is key is her inquiring mind. It's her ability to see a story. And she's actually from a documentary photojournalist background. Right. She's a very accomplished documentary photographer and music photographer in her own right. So she has a really powerful voice in all the work. And I think, you know, I remain incredibly grateful for her presence in my life, both personally, because we're great friends and we really trust each other, but professionally. Yeah. You know, so there's, and the same with Jim, I think. Jim and Camilla are the two people who kind of stood right by me. Mm. You know, often I'm coming up with the first idea, but it's them that, you know, that's just like a block of stone. Yeah. You know, it's pretty raw.
Yeah,
they're the ones that help me chisel and form and find the sculpture and the beauty that's sitting within a raw piece of data, a raw piece of information, a story that's kind of not yet been told.
Yeah.
So, no, I'm very grateful. And, I mean, it's a beautiful thing. I mean, I think when you're at my stage of a career, you know, 58, I've been doing what I've been doing, you know, 40 years in some ways, you know, the image making and storytelling, to have colleagues who you really trust and really love is you know, I mean, it's the gift that keeps giving, to be honest, because actually it's fun doing stuff, but it's really fun doing stuff with other people.
Yeah.
And with people that you love, I mean, it doesn't get any better.
Yeah.
Simple
as
that.
The team and the...
Simple as that.
Yeah, yeah. And the community even within the book and that project reflects throughout the community.
I think that's a really good point. I think actually one of the reasons this work actually has won award after award after award is not because I'm some unbelievable genius, because I'm not. I'm a hardworking boy from a village in southern Britain, and I happen to get lucky enough to partner up with some really other brilliant people, and between us, we've created some really special stuff.
I'm not
a great believer in the kind of, you know, there are light bulb moments in life.
Sure.
And there are, you know, the Einsteins out there.
Yeah.
But I'm definitely not one of those, and I definitely don't have light bulb moments. You know?
Well, are you a bit of a dreamer, a big picture kind of guy and go for, I mean, like you, like even the start the project, it was your idea. I mean, your name's on the book. I mean, and it's a team, of course. But
yeah, I'm not sure I did dream it up. I think we went through a really interesting process, a set of steps.
Yeah.
Organized, thoughtful,
intentional,
authentic, and through a whole set of relationships and conversations, an idea to create this process of recording human stories at this moment in time came to be.
Yeah.
It wasn't like I woke up one morning and went,
ta-da!
Human Atlas, here we come.
Yeah, it's that interaction and the community that builds it, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, in the Brazil project, you know, because I'm not a native Portuguese speaker, you know, Camilla did all the interviews.
Oh, wow.
You know, and I've had amazing photographic assistants, you know, Luciano Bonomo in Brazil, Joe Briggs Price for the other projects, who, you know, bring so much to the team. And I mean, we're now doing these amazing video pieces alongside it, which are really exciting, which you'll see one of the videos, and they're all on YouTube as well. If people subscribe to the Human Atlas YouTube channel, you can see the videos, and Joe and Camilla shoot all that.
I'm
just a bit part player. I mean, there are people who have light bulb moments. I don't want to deny any of you out there who are listening to this podcast that there aren't moments where an idea of pure genius arrives out of nowhere.
But the story is that we're all really in community, right? You know, none of us are self-made. we all get inspiration from other people. We all need each other's help in order to do it. And I think that's what the Human Atlas Project demonstrates. Even when you do an individual story of somebody, you start to see, like I saw, oh my gosh, I can't remember who it was, but they said, Jessica, I think from, I can't remember now, I'm going to get it right, but she said, you know, I'm my mother's daughter.
Jessica Pasadias.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. She's like, who are you? And her identity, the first thing that came with it, I'm my
mother's
daughter, right? Yeah. And that's the thing, is like we all have parents and connection and lineage, and that's what I think you bring out in this project, that community, that we're standing on the shoulders of giants, et cetera. Yeah.
I think it was Ariel who's in the iDetroit Human Atlas, and she said, you know, this whole idea of pulling, you know, I didn't pull myself up by my bootstraps. Right. I achieve what I achieve because people in my community helped me get there.
Yeah,
and I mean, I think we always like the kind of the story of the kind of, you know, the Clint Eastwood,
you know,
the man with no name. There's this sort of unique single figure who kind of, I think it slightly plays into kind of the whole kind of American Hollywood idea of the kind of, you know, the cowboy, the frontiersman, the kind of the maverick, as you say. But actually, it don't work like that.
It doesn't. You know, what's funny? You know, I was just thinking of all those kind of like stories too. It's always like the hero, right, is doing something. And then they introduce this one little character earlier. But it's always like the guy or whoever it is like there. And then they always get to the point where someone's going to surprisingly shoot them or something, and then it's the other person who does it. Not, you know what I mean? It just kind of even shows subliminally that there's more than just you in the world, right? Yeah.
And I think that's a beautiful message, really, to take from Human Atlas.
Is
that through community and through listening, caring for each other, building more equitable processes for us all to come up together, we actually, you know, what is it? Rising tide raises all the boats.
Yeah.
I love that idea. I mean, it's a natural metaphor, but actually there's this kind of human form, this boat that represents our aspirations and our possibilities.
Yeah,
I like that. I mean, you know, I think there are other people in our societies who kind of believe in this kind of individualistic kind of, you know, process, but No, I'm very much all for one and one for all.
Yeah, that's cool. How about you? What do you do to inspire you? Is there anything that you're reading currently, or?
Yeah, reading's always good. I'm very into my kind of political science and sociology books.
Yeah.
But
what's one that you've read recently that you?
I'm reading some great ones on LA right now.
Oh yeah.
Oh my God, there's some amazing ones. I'm reading Mike Davis's book City of Courts right now, which is just a must read for LA. But I mean, if I'm really honest, my inspiration is my children and my family.
Yeah.
You know, I lean back into that. You know, they're kind of my driver. They're my North Star.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I always think, you know, how would this run with my kids? You know, and they're really tough on me. Oh my God. They pick me up on everything, which is great. I like the challenge, but no.
What's their ages? What's your kids' ages?
Florence, Flo, is just 13. So I have a teenager, just.
Nice.
And Arthur is now just 11. Bright kids, inquisitive kids.
Great age.
Yeah. Flo's always singing. You know, you often hear her singing before you hear her talking in the day, which I love. And the little boy is, you know, he's all about numbers and rubric cubes and scoring great goals.
Yeah,
you know?
Awesome.
So, they're terrific. And, you know, they're definitely part of the team. You know, we have them here in San Jose now with us. They'll be helping, you know, on the welcome desk tomorrow.
Oh, nice.
There's a slide in my presentation with a picture of them. Yeah, no, We're really thick as thieves. We're having a good time together. We're very lucky. Family is, definitely my North Star right now.
Yeah. It's such a good age. That's such a fun age because they're really, right, becoming their own kind of, like, person, you know, but they're still that parental guidance, connection, love, and need, and yet they're still, like, in conversations and everything. That's awesome. And then can we talk about, because we're talking about identity a little bit, what's the story behind their names? behind Florence. You said Florence.
Florence and Arthur. I mean, we just needed names that worked in both languages. It had to work in both Portuguese and English. So,
okay.
Yeah. No.
So no major significance, family inheritance, or anything like that.
They just that was them. That was those are the two that were just there.
You like the names?
And we're not the sort of couple that wanted to know whether we were having boys or girls before.
Oh,
so
yeah.
You always had to have a couple of names, but no,
yeah.
they're delightful. And, you know, they, you know, since when, you know, bring it back to Human Atlas, when we're doing the projects, you know, and I'm interviewing people,
yeah.
Often that perhaps is the kind of the key question at the back of my mind is, what would they want to know about this human being?
Mm.
What are we trying to do with this work to help them navigate the world, make choices about what they're going to be committed to?
Yeah.
There's a real educational moment in Human Atlases. I mean, the Detroit one is now being taught as a university course in Michigan at Wayne State University.
Yeah.
And we've got high hopes that maybe the decoded work, as it now begins to disseminate, might have an opportunity to be taught in, you know, a charter school or a public school or maybe in one of the universities.
Yeah.
You know, so many important messages that come through the stories that the 101 in the book have told. So,
yeah
the kids definitely help us think about it as an educational piece.
Yeah.
What would they, you know, what would my 13-year-old want to ask this person about their life?
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah,
that's good. Then what is, let's just end with this here too, what for the Decoded book, this particular project, what would you say is, and I know it's not fair to do this, but if you had to bring it down, what is the lesson or what is learned through the overarching lesson of the Decoded project?
I think it's quite simple. I think through the 101 people we met here, we felt that all the answers to our most pressing problems already have people who are working on it here.
Cool.
We don't have to get that complicated, and we certainly don't have to be intimidated by them. They are big, awful, difficult societal problems: homelessness, racial equity, gender justice, you know, the whole piece about food security and cost of living crisis.
Yeah.
But the answers are already in our society.
Yeah.
All we've actually got to do is start listening to the right people and allow them to instigate the answers that they already have right there for us.
Awesome.
So I think Jessica, again, to quote her, I think she said in her interview, you know, it's not that complicated.
Mm.
All we got to choose is to decide what we give up so that others can thrive.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's just a little bit too much greed. There's a little bit too much, this is my stuff and I'm not going to share. I remember one of our guys in Detroit, Matt Naimi, who's an amazing revolutionary kind of recycler and environmentalist. And he has a motto, which is share your candy. You know, I mean, just you got your candy, it's in your hand, share it.
Yeah.
You know, don't go and like tuck it in your pocket and say, I'm not having, you know, share your candy, get out there, and you know, roll up your sleeves and start getting some work done. Just like Ryan says in the Decoded book, you know, it we've all got to do a little bit.
Yeah.
We've all got to lean into our communities and support each other, you know, do some stuff. You guys do community great here. And you've got great people doing great work in your community. So go find those people, give them, you know, ring them up, give them the chance for your support and a bit of your elbow grease to make a difference. And, you know, I think we can build a much more hopeful future if we do that together.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah. Cool. Well, thank you for your project and choosing, you know, our area. And thank you for letting me be a part of it. So super cool, and for doing this podcast, too. I really appreciate it. And then why don't you tell the camera all the how everybody can find it, where they can get it, and all those kind of cool things.
Well, before we do that, I'd just like to appreciate you
well,
and say that, you know, people like you who champion the art, the culture, the creative content of a place is, you know, it's amazing what you do, and you should be really proud of your contribution. Your contribution is very significant. How many years is it now?
12 years.
12 years at the coalface of telling other people's stories. So here's to you.
Yeah, well, here's to you in 10 years of Dakota. And,
so tell us how we can get... In terms of the book, this camera or this camera?
This one. Is that okay?
Camera.
Hey, is it rolling?
So Decoded Book is available for you through my studio. You can buy it online through marcuslyon.com. Go to the Decoded tab and then click on the order the book. It's also available online at ahumanatlas.com. So, you know, if a high quality, beautifully designed limited edition book is beyond your means, all the content, both visual, spoken, and genetic, is on ahumanatlas.com. So free to users, open source, everybody gets access to it. And then we have formed a partnership with Books Inc. in Palo Alto, mm-hmm. which is a local independent bookstore, and they will be stocking the book. So if you are passing through Palo Alto, I think it's in the Town and Country Mall, which is in the center of town, go and visit Chini, who's the bookstore manager there, and you can buy the books there or order them there, and we'll make sure you can get them picked up there, no problem. Thank you very much. I hope you enjoy the book. It's a slow read. There's a lot of information in there. It's 100 people you're inviting into your world. So 101, I should say. Thank you very much.
Cool. Thank you, Marcus. I really appreciate it. And thank you, Camilla and Joe and Jim, all parts of
all
your
team
that brought this. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Daniel. Pleasure to be here again. Yes. Lovely to see you. Thank you.
Salud. And asleep. Thank you for listening to the Content Magazine podcast. Follow us on social media at Content Mag. Become a member and help us to continue to tell the stories of the South Bay creatives. This episode's music is 408 by Jack Pavlina. Follow him on Spotify and also on his Instagram at Jack Pavlina Music.